Welcome back to the Ignite podcast. Today, we're delighted to have Joshua Perk on the program. He's the co-founder CEO of Vector, a Y Combinator-backed startup revolutionizing B2B sales pipeline generation. Joshua, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Brian. Great to be here.
And I'm trying to keep my energy level up because this is episode 50 of the Ignite podcast, so we're pretty excited about that. And but yet it's Monday morning, so my energy level is also down at the same time. But we'd love to get an intro from you for the audience.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brian. I feel like spending the last 2 years as a founder and then at a early stage company before that, my energy level's always somewhere between just like maniacally down and up at the same time. So I feel you on this Monday morning. But anyways, thanks for having me. So yeah, I, as you mentioned, I'm the CEO and co-founder of a Y Combinator-backed startup called Vector. We're really focused on helping revenue teams figure out how to leverage their network in order to get into their target accounts, expand their relationships. And prior to that, you know, I started my career in the Air Force, as did my co-founder. He was a pilot. I was an Intel analyst. And when you're transitioning out of the military, trying to figure out like how does looking at missiles and infrared signatures relate at all to the real world, you somehow find your way in sales engineering and solutions consulting, which is where I spent the rest of my career in the middle.
Yeah, I seem to be running into lots of military folks in tech. Why do you think that is?
I think it sort of fosters like a good environment. I remember there's a good buddy of mine named Joel, and when we were first working at Drift, we were sitting in sort of this like hoorah type meeting, right? And it was sort of like, hey, our revenue numbers aren't where they need to be. We need to go do sort of all these hands on deck. And there was this sort of like panic in the room. And there's nothing that can make you panic more than being shot at, right? Like there's just like, there's certain things that like builds this sort of like foundational, like
we are literally under fire right now. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So like
any of us could die.
Exactly. My wife and I are in the process of maybe packing up the house and moving right now. And it's one of those things that like, just for a lot of people, just the transitory period of moving is super stressful. And to me, it's just like a checklist, right? Like, what are the things we just got to go do to be successful with this?
So where you guys consider, is it the same town or like a different town move or?
No. So I think we're headed back to Florida, which is where we were before. My wife has a tendency of buying a house in like every place she enjoys visiting. So instead of vacationing, like most people, we purchase homes. And so the most recent long-term vacation was Raleigh and she liked it. And now she wants to go somewhere with more beaches.
I don't blame her. It's like in the winter, that's when that thinking starts to creep in. My wife and I moved to the Caribbean after college during the winter of Seattle. We're like, I think it was about middle of January. You know, it was 35 and perpetually gray and rainy. And I'm like, what if we just moved to the Caribbean? I just threw it out there. She's like, that sounds like a great idea.
Awesome.
And so we moved there.
I wish my wife would put places like that. We're always just ending up like in, you know, Tampa, Florida. I'd rather live in the Caribbean.
So tell us about Vector.
Yeah, so Vector was born out of this sort of like really personal observation I had. The first one that I had was that over my career as a pre-sales leader, I just had a lot of bosses. Specifically when I was at Drift, I think I had three CROs as a boss. And if you look at, you know, any sort of typical enterprise B2B sales team, this is pretty normal. Like the average tenure of a chief revenue officer is like 16 months. They're the first head to roll when, you know, a team
hit, miss your numbers. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's just like the public.
And then it's the head of marketing, I think, next.
Yeah, I think so. Right. It's like, go to the guy that like directly influences sales. And then after that, go to the guy or gal that like that says that they were supposed to influence the thing that the CRO said they were selling. Mm-hmm. Then I think after that, then you get rid of the CEO, I think, is the next person to blame. But, you know, so
last
I had to
go last. And then it's the head of product.
Yep.
And then last but not least would be, oh, crap, we actually aren't good at building. It's actually engineering.
Exactly. Yeah.
But you might have to cycle through all the other executives like two or three times before you realize that.
Then you pivot and blame the idea. Then you just like fold the company and blame the economy.
I see you've been through some, you have some startup war stories and scars like I do.
I've been through it. You know how it goes. But, so I went through that personal pain of just like having, you know, multiple CROs. And so it really made me start to question, like, why is it that so many people that their only job is to sell things fail to sell things. And I think there's like some ungodly number floating around on LinkedIn that's like 62% of all sales reps like fail to hit their number. And so, you know, I started taking a microscope and figuring out like, well why is this? And the thing that was really interesting was the way a majority of enterprise sales teams hit their number is like ridiculously antiquated. It's like picking up the phone and cold calling, it's cold emails. And like, even the best solutions today are like, how do we use AI to write like 10,000 more cold emails at scale? And so we just,
yeah, that's all we need is more cold emails.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So our big focus was like, how do we fix this? There's got to be a better way.
And so, yeah. So tell us about that. So really well put problem. Yeah. Tell us about the solution.
Yeah. So like the obvious extension to how do we break through cold noise is like, well, where can we go to find like warmer waters? And so majority of people have kind of figured this out already. It's like, how do we go on LinkedIn and use people that we're connected to? How do we ask our customers for intros? And so like the end state had kind of already been defined for us, which was kind of nice. We didn't have to guess what was going to work or wasn't going to work. But what was really broken was how people figure out where these relationships exist, right? So, you know, an average sales rep might go, if they were selling to you, pull up your LinkedIn, look at their mutual connections with you, see that they have four people that they overlap with, reach out to all four of them and ask them, like, do you know Brian well enough to make an intro?
Sounds
like
familiar, yeah.
Yeah, and 99% of the time, the answer is, like, no.
No, I met him at a blah-de-blah thing, like, I don't know, 5-10 years ago, and I don't really know who he is. Yeah.
Brian, do you remember the days when, like, LinkedIn, I think there was features where, like, you could only add people if you explicitly knew them? Remember that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I think at some point LinkedIn was like, no, we're a social media platform now, and we actually make lots of revenue by like having people stay on our platform and sell ads. So
I think it's a careful dance, you know, because my spouse and partner, Team Ignite, who does a lot of our portfolio development and go to market, she ran the go to market team there.
Yeah.
Product marketing. And so she knows a lot of the inside scoop of this kind of push and pull internally of like, how much spam do we allow? Because it's engagement, right? All these emails and cold outreaches and cold connection requests are engagement. And so you kind of don't want to shut it off. You're kind of hooked on the supply a little bit, you know?
Yeah. And I don't know. I'm totally making this up and I don't have the data for it, but I'm assuming LinkedIn makes significantly more money on their ad revenue than they do their sales products, like LinkedIn Navigator and these sorts of things.
Yeah. So. Sales Nav, I think there is like sort of this second or third kind of tertiary. They don't even look at it as their main business.
Yeah.
Even though like objectively it's a huge business.
Yeah.
It's just not their big business, which is the talent solutions.
Yeah.
The recruiting business. Yeah.
So they're more incentivized for your mutual connections to be worthless because it means more people are connected and viewing each other's content than they are to actually make them good for the sales product to know who, you know, who knows who. And so, you know, that was the big opportunity for us, which is, you know, how can we help surface who actually knows who. And even that part of the market was not novel, right? There's technologies out there that are trying to surface who your investors know, who your customers know, but they all do it through the same way, which is import your LinkedIn connections, import your calendar, import your email.
Your contacts maybe, yeah.
Yeah, import your contact book, right? If you're like, if they're super aggressive, they might say like, connect your WhatsApp or like just things that like people aren't
willing to. Let us scan all your emails that you've ever sent and received for all time.
Yeah. Exactly. And like, we just thought there was a lot of problems with this. There's like one, privacy security, right? Just like the ability to actually get people to do this is pretty difficult.
Yeah.
Two, even if you could get people to do it, isn't it basically just the same LinkedIn problem regurgitated, right? Like I've connected my LinkedIn. I've told you who I'm connected with on it, but does that mean anything about my relationships?
Yeah.
And then three is like, what is the extent of people that in your network you could ask to do this? Maybe your investors, you could ask them to come be users in a platform like this. Maybe your employees, you can mandate it, but can you really ask your customers and your champions like, hey, you're such a good customer, come sit in my platform where you're going to connect your LinkedIn so I can ask you to make intros for me. It doesn't scale super well.
Right.
And so what we had to build was super difficult, but we had to figure out like, is there a way to identify the authentic relationships that people have without them explicitly giving you any information, right? Can I go predict who Brian really knows without asking him to be a user at all in my platform?
which is where we invented our shared experience graph.
So tell us more about that. That sounds fascinating. So basically what you're doing is you're crawling, it sounds like the entire web,
yeah,
and trying to look for connections. Tell us about like some of that secret sauce and how that works.
Yeah. So basically, you know, we realize that especially, you know, our generation and newer, we leave a lot of digital fingerprints on the internet, whether it's social media, whether it's, you know, LinkedIn, not necessarily connections, but the things we post. There's a lot of information about where did we go to school. And so we kind of summarize all of these different fingerprints as shared experiences, right? Are there things that you did that other people also did? And when you look at them by themselves, they're not that interesting, right? It's like, hey, you and this other person worked at the same company. You and this other person went to the same school, right? You and this other person were at this community event that you posted about. That's not good enough to determine whether you know that. But when you start to look at multiple of these lines kind of pointing at each other, you start to see really interesting patterns where it's like, hey, you and this other person worked at the same company and you did that three times, right? Like you job topped three companies together. That's some sort of interesting pattern. And so we're looking at all this like metadata around the shared experiences to predict who knows who.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, Joshua is the keyword. And it's like a page rank of all the connections leading back to Josh.
Yes.
And everybody else is a page in the network. And it's just, you know, page rank.
Yeah. It's exactly that. And what we found was just staggering. So like we thought like if we're lucky, maybe like every company that buys our software will have like a small handful of people that know the companies they want to go out to. But it's almost like the old like, you know, N degrees from Kevin Bacon thing. It turned out that like when a customer gives us a target account list of say like 1,000 or 4,000 companies they want to go sell to, on average, we can find a meaningful relationship to 68% of the companies they want to go sell to, which is wild because we're spending our time sending cold calls and emails to these people.
Yeah. And it sounds like at least 2/3 of the time you could be getting a warm introduction and not just, you know, the random, hey, do you know Bob well enough for an intro on LinkedIn kind of connection? Yeah. But hey, this is a real strong connection that we've predicted is very strong. And you should go through, you know, these three channels. So tell us about some of the results. You've started implementing this and what are some of the things that your customers are experiencing?
Yeah, I think one of like the most exciting things, and I will leave this company nameless because I think they now look at Vector as their competitive differentiator against their competitors. But we have a company that has completely gotten rid of the concept of like cold calling and cold emailing, and all they're betting on in 2024 is to source all of their revenue through warm relationships.
That's amazing.
It's really neat.
Completely reinvented their entire sales process.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
And to me, this is really exciting because like I had the opportunity to work for folks like David Kensel at Drift, who came from sort of like HubSpot through his acquisition of Performable. Yeah,
historically, that's the content marketing, pound them over the face with content, get them to fill out a lead form, drip them until they MQL, SQL them, booked it like the classic, you know. Yeah.
Exactly.
Content marketing pipeline thing. Yeah.
It's exactly that. And so there's sort of this like this weird sense of victory over sort of this new way to do it. But also the things I respected about some of these folks, you know, like you know, Mark at Salesforce or David Kensel at Drift is they sort of did a really good job of creating these movements where it's like no software at Drift, it was no forms, right? And now I feel like we can authentically lead a movement of like no cold, right? No cold calling, no cold emailing. And like the biggest example of that is a customer that has completely said, we are only using your software to service our revenue now.
Yeah. And fundamentally, we're all just people talking to people, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, and it strikes me as like every time a new technology comes out, it's not that the old way of doing things goes away necessarily, right? We'll always have cold emails, right?
Yeah.
And we'll always have these random LinkedIn intro requests. And we'll always have content marketing. It's just like, here's another way. Here's another tool in the arsenal to unlock value, build pipeline, get in front of the right accounts, especially when you're kind of whale hunting and you're going after these big, you know, 6-7 figure kind of deals.
Yeah.
Make a lot
what
of sense.
I think is really enduring about the way Vector is doing it is, all those channels are still going to exist. But I believe that Vector is building the only channel that doesn't drop in performance, right? So like cold calling still going to exist, cold emailing still going to exist. But every time a new channel got created, there was sort of the spike of like immediate like success, right? Then every salesperson's like, oh, cold calling works? Like, I'm going to do that more. And then it started to drop off because as consumers, we hated cold calling. And then at the end of every cycle, you typically see this sort of like Hail Mary suite of technology that gets invented to try to extend the life of it. So like, auto dialers and Cisco, like phone trees.
Yeah, they turn it up to 10 out of 10. Just like, no, we're going to squeeze the last little, you know, drips of juice from this tactic. And now nobody even picks up their phone.
Yeah.
Right. Anybody that's sophisticated enough has the call filter from Verizon or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And you just don't even pick it up. You're like, probable spam. Okay, cool.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, you still get 10 calls a day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially somebody like me where my phone never floating out there all over the place, you know?
Yeah. I don't know about you. I just don't answer anything that's like not saved in my contacts at this point.
Yeah.
And so like,
shoot
me
a text first and like, you know, verify who you are.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, can you chat now? Yeah. Okay. I can chat now. You know? Yep.
And so I think we're at the kind of tail end of like the email version of this, right? Like Outreach and SalesLoft and these sort of like auto sequencer tools. And so like, to me, I think that like, are human relationships ever going to go out of style, right? Like, is it always going to be, instead of B2B or B2C, is it just always H to H, right? Is it humans just selling to humans? Because if so, you know, I don't think we're building something that has like a 10-year fad and then all of a sudden we're not going to be asking people, you know, to help us leveraging relationships.
Yeah. And a question I often ask myself in the back of my mind when I make an investment, like we did in you guys, obviously, you're in the portfolio, is why was the timing right for this? So maybe you could explain for the audience why the timing was right for this. And I'd love to also talk about a little bit. We met a year ago at Winter 23 YC.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I remember thinking like, you guys are super early. You don't have much, if any, revenue, and kind of walk us through why you had to defer and why that timing all kind of came together.
Yeah. So I think that like, There's a podcast that I love called How I Built This. I think it might be an NPR podcast.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah. And at the end of every podcast, I think it's Guy Raz that does it. And at the end of every podcast, he asks people, like, how much of your journey was like luck versus success or like hard work? And I think for us, there was an element of like, hey, we have founder market fit. Like, we know what's not working in this space. But there was certainly an element of just like really lucky things happening that allowed us to build it at this time. And so for us, like the two waves that allowed us to build this now, and it couldn't be built 10 years ago, was one, like regulation actually occurred to prevent like the current state from continuing, right? So like Google and Yahoo announced like some new things that they were going to put into the algorithm that would prevent the way that businesses could like spam masses. And so like immediately there was like this big spotlight on like what other technologies are we going to have to use. And so we got like a big boost from that. Also, and I'm sure every guest says this, is like the movements in AI was significant, right? Like the amount of data that we have to process in order to understand where relationships exist, like the advancements of like literally off the shelf AI that can now look at all of this to determine relationships just was massive step forward for us.
Yeah. So walk us through some of the, you know, experience of deferring, and are you guys officially now Winter 24 batch because you're going to this demo day? Like, how's all that work at YC?
Yeah, I kind of wish we were, because I think had like we officially like switched our tag in Bookface or Y Combinator, like maybe we would have gotten like a ton of interest and like our round would have closed in, you know, 2 days at, you know, a $50 million cap or something crazy. But we're still technically Winter 23. But we were graciously invited back by Y Combinator to participate in Winter 24's demo day, although our fundraise is done prior to hitting it, which is also always like a good place to be. But yeah, so we went through sort of the traditional founder story, which was like, we went to Y Combinator, we had like some crazy good idea at the time that, you know, all of our friends and family and, you know, our previous colleagues basically said like, if you build this, I'll buy it. So we went to YC, like we quit our jobs, we built this thing. And then we went to these folks that said they would buy it from us. And like, we immediately found out like, there's a big difference between like, the things people say they will buy versus what they actually will buy.
Yeah. Classic product manager, entrepreneur mistake. I've made it multiple times.
Yep. Yeah. Just everyone's being nice to us, right? Or like maybe they wanted to buy it, but
your baby's so beautiful. You know, this is such a great idea. You're so smart.
And so you have to pull the checkbook out, right?
Then yeah. Great. Can you sign a letter of intent or would you sign up for 10,000 a year? No.
Exactly. So we got hit in the face. I think it was literally on day three of Y Combinator. We were in San Francisco at the retreat. We called all of our friends and buddies that had said that they would buy this thing. We said, like, we quit our jobs. We're building this thing. Come do exactly what you just described. Sign an LOI. And it became clear that, like, we hadn't sussed this out. This wasn't something that people really wanted, or if they did want it, there was going to be tons of like security issues. That what we were building is like another story.
What was this thing? What was the initial thing?
We were going to convince every CRO to give us their Salesforce data, and we were going to basically build a benchmark platform where if you were a sales rep going to sell to Stripe, you could log into our platform and we would tell you of the last 20 deals that like Stripe evaluated, here's how long it took them to go through procurement. Here's whether or not they bought something or not. Here's whether like another sales rep wasted a bunch of time. So basically a co-op of like CRM data.
Yeah.
And we found out like, this is basically a two-sided marketplace. CROs and sales reps loved this. They wanted this insight to like, how do I avoid time or like, what should I expect the negotiation will be like? But then ops like didn't want to provide the data to participate in the co-op. It was like a cold start issue kind of thing. So we got to pivoting pretty quickly in the batch. Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah. So we pivoted. Unfortunately for us, like when you and I first started talking, like we hadn't figured it out. Right. Like we didn't know exactly what that idea was. We had some things that were kicking around. And like one of the things that I've always found a little bit different in our founding team than maybe like the traditional YC batch is just our age and tenure, right? Like, you know, Nick and I are coming off of, you know, 10, 15, 20 year careers already.
Yeah.
And so like a lot of the money that was in our company was like people that believed in us. It was like our past bosses and you know, all these sorts of folks. And so we were unwilling to kind of go to demo day, raise a bunch of money on like a hope and a dream and try to make that happen. And so we did like the really hard thing of saying like, we don't have a lot of cash in the business, but I'm certainly not going to bring in other investors' money that we don't know how to protect. And so we did the right thing. We pivoted away from it. We spent like the next 6 months in darkness trying to like build the right thing.
Yeah. That's the end. That's always a perilous journey, right?
Yeah.
Kind of going, ooh, my baby's ugly and I need to completely go back to the drawing board and figure out, you know, I know the audience. I know what their problems are.
Yeah.
But I got to figure out what they'll pay for.
Yes.
And, and you have to uniquely figure out like technically what are we capable of delivering?
Yes. Yeah.
Within a time frame of, you know, call it 12 months.
Yeah.
That's about probably the runway you had at that point.
It was, yeah. And mind you, 2023 wasn't exactly like the year people were buying anything, right? Like it used to be like, you know, growing up as like a YC fanboy, right? It used to be one of these things where it was like, build an MVP, you know, go put it out in the market and see if people are willing to do it. You know, especially in B2B enterprise sales, there is sort of this like higher threshold now where it's like, not only do you need to be selling me, well, one, we might not be buying software at all, even if the software you're selling me is like a dollar printing machine. and two, if you're selling me a dollar printing machine, like is the dollar printing machine like the top one problem I have right now? And so like the status quo of like building things in 2 weeks and hoping it's enough to sell enterprise deals is like not true anymore. You have to sell like a minimally made lovable product instead of like viable at this point.
Yeah. I like that. Well, I think what you're describing is the bar is getting much higher for friends and family rounds, angel rounds, pre-seed rounds, right?
Yes.
And, you know, it used to be, you know, like you, and you could go like read the book Power Law and kind of like read the origins of venture capital. It used to be like, oh, you're pretty smart and you got an idea and a big market. Here's like $5 million, $10 million to go figure it out.
Yeah.
And now it's become like this, well, it's pretty easy to stand up some software, but it's really hard to find product market fit.
Yeah.
And so now investors kind of wait for you to have a little PMF.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Not complete, but it's like, okay, 100, 250,000 of ARR somewhere in there.
Yeah.
That's typically where we like to invest because it's like, okay, you've hacked something together. People want to pay for this.
Yep.
And now you need to hire to do more.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, go ahead.
There was a post I saw on LinkedIn, and I don't know if this was like poking fun at or commending founders, but it's true. It's basically like the bar used to be like go to Y Combinator, get 10K in MRR, and like easily get funded kind of thing.
Yeah.
And this post I saw on LinkedIn was like the modern playbook for founders is like build something in 3 weeks, sell it to their friends, right? Get 10K in MRR and then go get funded. And I think VCs are getting super smart to this, right? They're basically like, I got asked every single pitch, right? Like how many of these people do you know, right? Like how many of these like believed in you sort of thing? Because I think it's the bar is now not only do you have revenue, but we were getting asked like, have you gone through renewals, right? Like how, show me usage data, right? Things that you would typically not see in a seed round, the bar has gotten raised for sure.
Yeah. Especially as that revenue sits out there for a while, how much of it's monthly, how much of it's annually, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So what's the vision for Vector? Like, where does this, what does this look like in 10 or so years?
Yeah, I think for us, what we realize is that like the world is powered by these relationships. And so like step one is sure, get the intros to sales teams. But at the end of the day, like the biggest flaw in any go-to-market team is typically in the CRM today. And I promise you, we're not one of those companies that's like, hey, we're going to go compete and be the new CRM. Like we think there's plenty of like really good competitors already battling for that, whether it's Salesforce or HubSpot or Gong or Clary. Like there's good companies that are going to do it. But the problem with all of them, regardless of who the incumbent or the winner of that becomes, is like CRMs are inherently reflections of relationships a business already knows they have with their customers and their prospects, which to us is like a pretty tumultuous situation, because the number one question that gets asked in boardrooms and forecasting meetings is, who do we know that we don't know we know, right? So, you know, the deal that you're counting on for the quarter slips and your stakeholder gets fired and now you're starting from ground zero. Like the number one question I always got asked was like, you know, who knows somebody that can get us back in that deal?
Right,
and
right.
We've all been in that boardroom where like magically there's typically some old guy or gal sitting in the corner that's like, yeah, I just went golfing with like that guy's son the other day, right?
Right. Right.
And but the CRM doesn't reflect that like old wise person's relationship. So for us, we are building the data platform that will sit on top of the CRM to answer all of the who knows who questions.
I like that. Well, let's switch to a rapid fire, kind of wrap things up.
Yeah.
What's your favorite book on entrepreneurship?
Gosh, I've got a bunch sitting on my desk, but the one that I'm reading through right now that I think has been really good is, there's a woman that I love named, April Dunford. She's written a couple books. One's called Obviously Awesome, which is, I think, one of the ones that most people know. She also recently put one out called Sales Pitch, but, I'm a huge believer in that certain categories of startups are built, or made successful, not just on the technology, but the way that you go and brand your product and understand your users, specifically for us in revenue tech, right? You look at companies like Gong, did they win because they had the better call recording software over Chorus? Like, no, like they won because like they understood their user super well. And we're able to sort of brand and say the right thing. So, you know, for anybody that's not in like a super deep tech category, you know, books around brand and messaging, I think are awesome.
Yeah. I mean, fundamentally, I mean, sometimes the best tech does not win. Look at Microsoft.
Yeah.
You know, usually it's not the best tech. It's,
yeah,
it's good enough tech.
Yeah.
That's all bundled together and interoperable and secure and enterprisey and all that stuff.
Yeah.
What's one technology you can't live without?
Oh, I'm going to go like a different direction here, right? I think like the common one is like software that they're using. There's a subscription technology that you're going to laugh at. It's called the Panera Sip Club. It's a monthly $9 subscription that allows you to get a coffee every single morning in this. This is like my go-to.
$9 right a month?
Yeah, dude, it's insane, right? And like,
that's a great deal.
It's a really good deal. And I
just walk in and just fill up your coffee at the thermos or whatever.
Plug in your phone number and you can get unlimited coffee, unlimited like powered drinks, teas, whatever you want. And so, maybe it's not as sexy as like a device or technology, but it's one of those things where it's like I'm pulling 20-hour days right now and I have two kids under three. That's the technology getting me through life right now, man.
Yeah, the Panera Sip Club. You've heard it. Oh, that's amazing. I didn't even know that existed.
Sign up with my referral link in the comments.
Yeah. Put the QR code. That's amazing. What's the most influential person in your career?
So it's funny. I typically have like two answers, and it depends on who. I'll give you like the cop out answer, which is like my dad. You know, everyone's got that sort of like the person they've seen. Like, I remember my dad, like OG work from home professional, right? And so I remember being nine, sitting at like the kitchen counter, like listening to conversations about like how to be like a great professional.
Yeah, sometimes you have to listen, but sometimes you have to ignore. Yeah. And that's the wisdom of going through that process and learning that difference. And it's hard to explain without having been punched in the face as an entrepreneur or a product manager or something like that. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on. This was amazing. I could have talked to you for a lot longer, but I know you're busy, so we'll keep it as short as possible. Thanks.